get him to accept that. And the same thing was true when he was with the Bulls. They got the other players to accept their roles and understand that Jordan and Pippen are probably going to get most of the publicity and most of the praise, but they wouldn't be on championship teams if they didn't have these others doing their job and accepting their job.
John, over the years, at least in recent years, I think the only coach that really reminds me so much of you and your philosophy and the way you motivate and the success to some degree that you had is Mike Krzyzewski at Duke. When you look at him, do you see any similarities in the way he approaches the game, the way he coaches, and the success that he has that's anywhere near what and the way you approach the game?
Yes, I do, but I've also seen some others that haven't won national championships. One of the greatest pleasures I've had since my retirement happened just last year, just before the Final Four. I was speaking for the McDonald's High School All-American game in Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina, and Mike wanted me to come over and visit with him and talk with his players and then watch him conduct a practice, which I did, and that was just 2 days before they were leaving for the, well, actually, it's the next day they left for Minneapolis for the Final Four, and I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the way he conducted practice. I actually felt that one of my strengths was my organization, the conducting of practice. I never considered myself much as a strategist or a great bench coach, but I did feel that my strength was in practice organization.
You know, when I take a look at the landscape in college basketball today, there are so many other dynamics that you didn't have to deal with, notably kids leaving early, the money being dangled in front of them. Has that changed the manner in which coaches have to approach kids and motivate them today? Is it different than the way you were? I mean, you were somewhat of a benevolent dictator in a sense, John.
I really don't think it's changed at all. I think you're still going to go after the same players and try to get them. No, you may not keep them as long. But I think too much concern is being made on the college program, their program being hurt because the better players leaving, many of them. I don't think we should be, paying too much attention to that. Let's pay attention to these youngsters giving up the education. There's very few of them that are going to be able to, like a Kobe and Garnett and some of those that make it big. For every one of those that make it big, many, many fail. And the average life of a pro player is under, in the NBA, I understand, is under 4 years. And I think we should be more concerned about what we can do to educate them to realize the value of their education.
Has college basketball, the cohesiveness, been changed a bit, John, because of the fact that coaches, when they recruit a blue-chip type of player, can't count on that player being there all 4 years like you could?
Well, the longer you have them together, the more team play you're going to have. And I felt all along that the players today, the athleticism is so remarkable. They've become so good individually that has hurt team play. I think coaches tend to let players go on their own a little more because they are so good and can get so much done individually. And I see better individuals, I think, the athleticism better than ever before, but I don't think I see as good team play as we used to have.
One of your former players also and Hall of Famer, Bill Walton, and I were chatting about what makes things successful today, and he says a coach's system to be successful, players have to buy into it, and he talked about you, and he put it this way.
If you're thinking about yourself, if you're thinking about the money, if you're thinking about the publicity and the statistics, and you're always blaming others for all the problems that inevitably come up in a group dynamic, it's never ever going to work. And so you got guys like Riley, like Jerry Sloan, Phil Jackson, and Larry Brown succeeding for long, long periods of time, and you see their players over the years looking back and say, gee, was I ever so stupid. And when I talk to Coach Wooden, and I see him all the time, I apologize so profusely for being quite possibly the slowest learner that he's ever had.
Was he that slow, John?
Just the opposite. Did you know that? Bill had that way about him. He's a most interesting individual, very bright. You may not know when he was hurt. He was in the law school at Stanford for a while.
Right.
Then he came back and tried to play some more, but unfortunately his feet wouldn't permit that. But he's the most unusual person. He became very articulate by taking speech therapy and by studying newscasters and sportscasters and worked very hard, but as his mother said, they taught him how to speak, but forgot to teach him how to stop.
That is a great line. You must be mostly proud of the fact that the lessons that you taught on the basketball court carried over to so many players in life.
Oh, I'm very proud of the fact, for example, that almost all of my players got their degrees in my 27 years, and all, practically everyone has done reasonably well in whatever profession they chose. There's been, you know, about 30 attorneys, 8 ministers, there's doctors, dentists, businessmen, teachers, and I just got... Does my heart good to see them do well.
Well, I'll tell you what, the lesson I learned from you, and I've quoted it many times in this program, after an NCAA tournament game, you were in the press conference, and you said, and you were talking, generally speaking, turnovers are like walks in baseball. They'll kill you every time.
That's right.
John, take care. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much, and I think it'll do real well. I think Andy did a great job bringing out some of the things that I tried to do in teaching basketball over into his business.
John Wooden, one of only 2 men to be inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame twice, once as a player, another as a coach, and of course was selected as coach of the century. And when he was at UCLA, he won 10 national championships in 12 years, with the Bruins winning 7 consecutive, and one of those that was on 2 of those championship teams and also part of the 88-game consecutive win streak was Jamal Wilkes. He played for Coach Wooden, where he was a 2-time All-American. Jamal, I know there are a lot of memories when somebody lives 99 years and has such an outstanding career as Coach Wooden did, but I want to ask you about the first time you met him, the thoughts you had in meeting John Wooden.
Well, thanks, Ron. first time was when they were recruiting me out of high school, and Coach Crum, Denny Crum, was doing the most of the recruiting. I met him briefly on my first visit to UCLA. And it was very nondescript, but he was the closer when it came down to making a decision, and he came up and took my mom and I out to dinner, and I just recall being on such tremendous anticipation of that meeting, pinching myself the whole time, and he was just so unassuming and understated, and the only thing he promised me was that I'd get a good education and an opportunity to play, and it was very different. I was highly recruited coming out of high school, and a lot of the coaches were, you know, off, you know, you do this and you might get that and this, that, and the other, and he was just totally the opposite of what 80 to 90% of the coaches that recruited me were like, and I just remember my mother just fell in love with him. So did my dad. They both had to... utmost respect for him, but I'd really hear about it most from my mom.
What was it that was his secret as far as bringing players, diverse players with different backgrounds, together and getting them to play as a unit?
You know, Ron, we marvel at that, his players. When we talk about him, a guy from Martinsville, Indiana, which is so unlike Los Angeles at a time when, you know, there was real questions going on throughout our society, and I once asked him, you know, what was the years later when I could begin to get a clue. I mean, this wasn't too long ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. What was his secret to his success? And after 15 minutes of arguing with me that he was not successful, then I said, okay, coach, whatever you call it, what were the keys to your success? And he looked at me, Ron, and I know you can appreciate this because we're good buddies. He said, well, you know, Jamal, first of all, I cared. And I hope the players really felt that. And he looked at me like he needed assurance that we did. I mean, that was really important to him. That's my point. It was deeply important to him. And I think that's what enabled to relate to such a diverse group of characters at such a challenging time. And then his second thing was organization. And there was, I have not met anyone that was better organized than Coach Wooden.
You know, when I stopped to think about his success on the basketball court, I remember doing ball games, broadcasting games when I was behind the booth or behind the bench, and the things that he would say during timeouts, and then I'd watch you guys come out on the court, and you would adapt and you would adhere to what he said. How did he get his point across from a basketball standpoint?
Well, Ron, excellent question, because from a basketball standpoint, we did 99% of it in practice. This man was a genius. when it came to managing basketball practice and managing the season. Early on in the season, at the beginning, well, first day, he took nothing for granted to show his attention to detail, and you've heard this story. He would go through a 20, 30-minute presentation on how to put your socks and shoes on. And you have a room of, you know, highly sought after high school All-Americans, and he's going through this very intensely. And if you knew him at all, he did not mince words. Every word meant something. Every word was said for a reason. And so to have that demonstration the first day of season set the whole tone. Now, early on in the year, Ron, he was a feisty, highly competitive guy. I mean, you can't be an All-American player as he was in the Hall of Fame as a player and not be extremely competitive. And early in the season, he was his most critical of us, the players, of how we were doing things. Now, his practices rarely went beyond a couple hours. He wasn't one of these 3, 4, 5 hour guys. He was that efficient with his time. Every drill meant something, was there for a reason, and created the physical, emotional, and mental balance in us that we could do what your question asks, adapt to him in the huddle, in the heat of battle, because we were so pliable from his training and his technique that we could do that, and we could anticipate 9 out of 10 times in a certain play where our teammate was going to be just from how he orchestrated practice. I know that's hard to understand, but when you go through a practice or you hear a guy that played for him in, 1950 and then 1970 through 74, the practices were not that much different. And he had his note cards. He always had his note cards. He was always very observant and quick to point out errors, but never demeaning in any way. Never said, we got to go win 73 of these 88 games in a row that we won. Never made an issue about it. You would have never thought it was happening if you didn't read about it or in the media or see it, hear it on television. At that time, we didn't have the internet. All he asked was that we give it our all. We'd be the best that we could be, and if we did that, that's all. That he was happy. He was okay.
Jamal, the one thing I think most people would think is that he was a perfectionist because the manner in which the UCLA teams played and the number of championships that they won. But I always came away in observing him and listening to him and talking to him on the program that he really would be willing to accept something less than perfection as long as he knew both the individual and the team collectively played the best that they could possibly play when they played.
I totally agree with you. That was his only criteria, was that the individual and the team collectively played the best they could. He could live with the outcome no matter what it was.
What do you think his legacy will be long-term? People can point to the championships, but I really think it's a human legacy because when you live 99 years and you have the closeness and the affection that everybody that came in contact with him and also especially the players that played for him, to me that is his legacy more than what he accomplished just purely in basketball.
Yes, I mean it's hard not to marvel at what he did accomplish in basketball, and from my small, selfish point of view, I still pinching myself. I can't believe that I was that. But I totally agree with you. I think when you look at not the adoration, but just the love that across the board all his players have, even those that, not just the Kareems and the Waltons, but even the Swin Naders who never started for him, Andy Hill, who had a falling out with them, one of the rare cases. These two guys probably love him the most, and you would not think that would be the case.
John Wooden touched many people, and he'll always be remembered and respected. Finally, in my broadcasting career, I've interviewed thousands of athletes. I'm often asked about my favorite athlete or interview. It's hard to just pick one, but on my short list of all-time favorite interviews and people is Adonal Foyle. Foyle is the personification of determination and personal success. He grew up on a small Caribbean island that was 3.5 miles by 1.25 miles with a population of 1,000. Raised by his grandmother and great aunt who gardened for a living by growing peanuts and other crops, his home had neither electricity nor running water. He didn't play organized basketball until he was 16. He was brought to the United States by a white couple who were professors at Colgate University. Under their guardianship, he got his degree from Colgate and was drafted in the first round by the Golden State Warriors. After a 13-year solid but undistinguished career, he recently announced his retirement. Given where he grew up, I asked Foyle if it blows him away that he played in the NBA for 13 years.
Absolutely blow me away. I mean, it's incredible. When you go back to the Caribbean and you kind of look at, and I look at where I came from and kind of like pie in the sky. I mean, I had no idea what I was doing. I told my mom that I wanted to leave the island with two complete strangers who later became my legal guardian. I mean, it was the craziest thing. You know, I have just met them, Jay and Joan Mandel, who became my legal guardian, they're professors from Colgate. I mean, when I look back and I'm like, after knowing these people for about a week, I said, I'm going to go to the United States and I'm going to go and play basketball and get an education. I mean, what a crazy notion for somebody who was living on an island of 500 people at the time. It's absolutely astonishing.
Tell me about the first time you picked up a basketball, because you were only 16 years old when you started playing.
It's like 15 and early 16, end of my 15th year. And I remember I just came from Canawan to Union, which is a big metropolis because they had about 3,000 people as opposed to the 500 in Canawan. And my first day, I was going to school. And my first day, there's a young man on the step, and he's like, man, you got to play basketball. And he just kept pestering me about playing basketball. You're tall. You got to play basketball. So I was like, after about a week of like, you know, man, get away from me. You know, it's bad enough. It's my first day of school. I'm the tallest person. I hated my height because everybody looked at me as, you know, this awkward person. And I went in the court, and I remember you explained the rules to me. And I said, okay, fine. You know, sounds good. And he told me to rebound, pass the ball to him, and he's dribbling between his legs and doing all this stuff. So I'm like, you know, man, why can't I do some of that? So, you know, I grab a ball, and I ran the length of the court, and I laid it up, and then I looked back, you know, expecting to get some high fives, and everybody was on the ground laughing, hysterical. Apparently, my zeal to run down the court, I had forgotten to dribble the ball. That was kind of my introduction to basketball. So when you think of that and you think about 13 years of basketball in the NBA, that's pretty incredible.
Did you take to basketball naturally and comfortably?
No, I did not. It was, I think what came natural was my running. Once I grew into my body, I loved to run. So I ran, I was very fast, and I had good timing. Those are the two things that I think initially that made me stand out. So after that, you know, it took a long time to kind of get to basketball, get the nuances of the game, the feel, the touch. I learned a lot from Mark Grabo. He was a strength and conditioning coach over at Golden State. And he just had me do things like, you know, not seeing the ball and just turning around and whipping the ball at my head. And, you know, my instinct kicked in and I start, you know, getting a good feel for the ball. He worked with me a lot in that. And that, you know, definitely fortunate for Mark because he kept me in shape. He tried to figure out ways to get me, because he figured like once I was in motion, I was good. Once you teach me something, I can keep it, you know. So he taught me a lot about the feel. And then Clifford Ray was when I really started to learn basketball when he came with Golden State. He really taught me a lot about the game.
One of the things that I've known about you in all the years that I've known you is the fact that I don't see you as the typical jock. I mean, you're articulate, you're intelligent, you went to Colgate. And I'm just wondering how hard, Donald, it was for you to acclimate yourself to the other nuances of the game, the in-your-face type of nuances.
I never did. I remember my first year in the league, I had I left Colgate a year early. And I remember my first year, you know, I was like, I'm going to finish my degree. And I came on the first road trip, and I had, like, about a bag of books. And I just remember the look that I got. You know, I had all of these books, and I sat down in the chair, and I had, like, stacks and stacks of books doing research. And I remember all the players came onto the plane, and they're just looking at me like, what is this kid doing? You know? But, I mean, that's kind of the way I've always been. I always thought that I was part of it and always on the outside of it because I never really fell for a lot of the stuff that, you know, frankly, that makes guys happy. Because I always felt that it was just a game and that it was just part of my life.
Your personal story is an interesting one as well. You've already alluded to the legal guardians. They were professors at Colgate University, a man and a woman. They were white, by the way. Tell me a little bit about how that relationship even came about.
Well, I think, you know, we were, I had just started playing basketball and I wasn't very good, but I was tall and I can block a shot. And I remember the local team from my island, they had won the tournament that will send them to Dominica to play in this OECS tournament. And it was there that Jay and Joan, they were doing research. And at the time, they would just, they go down and they help out the referees, help manage the table, help out the referees with the rules and stuff. And he used to be a referee. So he loved going down to the Caribbean and teaching the game of basketball to the referees. And his wife managed the table. And his son was, you know, just looked on. And so we came into this tournament. We were a ragtag bunch. I mean, we dance onto the court. Whether we got killed by 40 or 50, we dance off the court. This was the first time many of us was leaving the island. So we were like in cloud nine. We were staying in this house with no AC, no nothing. And we thought this was the greatest thing ever. We were bathing in the river. And it was the most extraordinary thing. We had such a wonderful time. And you know, so they obviously fell in love with the team because we were losing, we were getting killed, and yet, you know, nobody could stop us. We were the happiest bunch in the tournament. So they came up to me and said, you know, have you ever thought about, you know, using your mediocre basketball skills to get an education? And the whole team decided that at that moment that they were going to take me to the States. So they're like, yes, he's going to go with you. And they're like, go where? We're just asking. We're not asking him to come with us. And they're like, no, you got to take him. So I remember, yeah, they 2 weeks later, they said, you know, if you want to come, we will. We have been talking to some people, and we think we can find you a place to go to stay in the United States, and we can go to school. And we can't promise anything. We don't know what's going to happen, but you know, we're going to try to help you get an education. And that's what I remember most. And not a week later, I was in the United States in Philadelphia, going to high school.
I remember running into the Sylvia touring team here in San Francisco, and a lot of those athletes had never been to the United States before, and I happened to be doing a television story on them, and I'll never forget going into a grocery store, and I bet it was 15 minutes that about five of those guys just stood there, their mouths open. They couldn't believe seeing that the shelves were stocked right, compared to what they saw in the Soviet Union. So let me turn it around a little bit. Let me ask you, you come to a country that you had heard of but could not even dream of or imagine, and you get to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, one of the largest cities, multicultural cities. Your first impressions?
Oh, it gets better. Before I actually landed in New York because I was supposed to get to Philadelphia, but for some reason I end up on a plane going to John F. Kennedy, and I had no idea. I've never really been in a plane before. I have never been in such a big city, and I am standing in the middle of the airport, and I'm thinking, I am gone. Somebody's going to take me and do something with me. I am forever gone. My mom is never going to hear from me again, and I'm standing completely lost and about to cry in the middle of JFK, and the prime minister of my country, who was on the flight with me, came with an entourage and swooped me up and took me to my plane and got me the plane to go to Philadelphia. I was not ready. You got to understand, and the island that I grew up on, County One, is about 3 miles long, and there were one car. It was a broken down car. I can't even remember what it was. It was a yellow broken down something. I don't remember what it was. And I landed in Philadelphia, and it was an ocean of cars. I mean, there was a traffic jam about 7 miles long. I stood there like dumbfounded. I could not believe it. I'd never been in an elevator. I was so afraid that I would shake the elevator and it may fall down that I held my breath all the way up to the fifth floor and almost passed out. I've never been in an escalator. It was, everything was new. I've never had a pizza. I remember I ate a whole one the first time I was there. So everything that first year in Philadelphia was new for me. And it was, I went around with my mouth open literally every day.
You go to Philadelphia, and as I already alluded to, a multicultural city and one that has sensitivities when it comes to race. You and I have talked about this before. Well, what was your first reaction, and did you run into any racism at all? And I would think that because you came from such a small country, island country, that you probably were oblivious to any of this, and it might have even protected you and helped you a little bit, O'Donnell, in dealing with some of the barbs that you may have run into.
Yeah, I think, you know, at the time, I was, I was so lost. I spent that whole year in fog. I mean, everything was so new that I think I completely was oblivious to a lot of things that year. So I did not have any experience, negative anyway, that I was cognizant of at the time. Mainly, it was everything was so difficult for me, basketball-wise, learning. I mean, I was tall, but I wasn't strong. I was fast, but I wasn't flexible. So, I mean, everything was a learning process. But in terms of race, I didn't have a bad experience at all.
When you got to Colgate University, a very high academic school, what was that acclimation like?
That was difficult because I think leaving Philadelphia, it was so big, it's very, very big. And then you go to a place like Colgate where you're in a little town of about 1,300, and then Colgate is the central part of the town. And I was the one black person, I think, in the whole entire school. And, you know, the kids were looking at me like I was like a science project. So, it was fascinating that I really become aware of, like, racism there. Not that it was towards me, but it was, like, the lack of knowledge about people like me. You know, and they were very great. You know, they used me a lot and talked to me about it, and they wanted to know what I thought about it, because the perception that they had was what they saw on television, was there was nobody like me there in that town. So I think it was a kind of a learning process for all of us about race. And I felt like, you know, I was almost always like a show and tell. You know, this is O'Donnell. O'Donnell is black. O'Donnell's from the islands. And it was really fascinating. I mean, I felt great about it because it was genuine wanting to know my life story and wanting to experience what I experienced, and as an African American, as somebody from the Caribbean. And I think we grew together and learned quite a bit.
What about the stepped up level of competition of college basketball?
I think that was really difficult because we went one of the things when I went to Colgate, I told coach that he needed to beef the schedule up a little bit so that I can get a lot of exposure, because I knew that by not going to a Duke or Syracuse or one of those big schools, that there were going to be a drought, I think, of serious competition. So I wanted to beef the schedule. So we added Stanford, we added Syracuse, we added a bunch of really good teams to the schedule. And it was very difficult because I was learning, I think, as quickly as I could, but it's like the competition keep getting better and better. And I keep being forced into the spotlight for that team. So it was very difficult for me, and it was a learning process, one that I relish, but by no means was it easy.
Let me ask you about expectations, because if you happen to be a black man, the sport is dominated by African Americans, black athletes, so there's an expectation they're going to be outstanding. If you happen to be big, there's what they call the big man's mentality of, well, and if you're going to be that big, you're probably going to be able to dominate as well. Did you have to deal with that along the way, and were you comfortable with everybody else's expectation of O'Donnell Foyle?
I think that in the Caribbean, it's like, I had never been a really aggressive person in terms of, like, you know, how I saw the game. The way the game was played, you know, is like you made a move, you know, but it wasn't, it was so physical. I think that the physical part of the game and understanding that, you know, for me, being a defensive player is about being like, not about laughing. I mean, I see very much of Dwight in myself. It's like when you're young, is that you're having fun and you're enjoying yourself. And then all of a sudden, it's like you're asked to corner a team and says, you need to carry this team and you need to do everything you possibly can. And I think that was a struggle, because for me, I'm a very jovial, I'm happy-go-lucky kid from the islands, and everything, it was funny for me. I was having a good time, and coach would be there, come on, you got to dominate, you got to rip this guy head off and spit down his throat and take this one and throw it. You know, so it was like, oh, my God, you want me to do that?
Somebody may not like me.
Exactly. So somebody might take offense to that. You know? So that was definitely something that I had to get used to. But I thought that once that I understood that this is how the game was played and it was different, then it got a lot easier.
Yeah. Let's also, what I'd be interested in is that when you knew that you were going to be able to maybe play at the next level, how did you approach that? And how did the people around you who were protective of you and wanted to help you with that approach it as well?
Well, it was scary because basketball, I had said that I wanted to do 4 years, and there was nothing that was going to stop me from doing 4 years. I wanted to graduate. I promised my mom that. And then, after my sophomore year, going into my junior year, things, Coach and I, we didn't quite see eye to eye on a lot of things because we were challenging ourselves with the schedule, and I wasn't getting, I thought, the kind of quality teaching that I need. So the question became is that, if I'm going to be playing in a conference that is not particularly powerful in terms of getting me prepared for the NBA, and I wasn't getting the individual attention, which is really what I wanted as a young player, then the question is, what do I do? And then I think it so happened that after my junior year, we got a call saying, you will go very high in the draft if you were to enter the draft. And my parents, being classic academians, they said, okay, let's have a conversation. And, let's put everything on the table. And it was really interesting because, my first impression was, no way, I'm not leaving. I'm going to spend my thing. And so we start talking about, okay, so what are the pros and cons? What do you want to do? Would you graduate even if you leave early? And the answer was, yes, of course, I'll graduate and I'm going to continue my education. So once that was answered, then it was, okay, now could you learn in terms of what would be your growth to spend another year from a basketball perspective, not an academic one? Because an academic one I knew I was going to do for the rest of my life. And the question became, from a basketball perspective, the growth is probably going to be limited. Whereas if I go pro, I'll have an opportunity to learn quite a great deal. Is going to be difficult, but it would be a great opportunity to really push my game to the next level. Because after all, at this point, I was doing pretty well and very easily in the Patriot League. So I needed to get to the next challenge. And so, we all said then, we said, I think we just made a decision. and then I basically went pro.
Yeah, I don't know what you knew about the NBA or what you knew about draft day. Maybe you had seen it on television and everything. But what was the experience like when draft day comes about and you hear the name of Donald Foyle called out with the eighth pick?
Well, I just remember my poor mother. This was the first time she came to the United States, and she's sitting at the table and she is just petrified. And I am sitting there and I can't help her because I am a nervous wreck. And we're all looking at each other and we're like, there's a very good likelihood that I'm not going to be drafted. I think so. They keep telling me I might be, but the first number call, the second number, and I'm thinking, I'm just going to be on national television. I'm never going to get picked up. So it was emotional. I was an emotional wreck. And when my name was called and I went across the stage and shook the commissioner's hand, I had no idea what to expect. I mean, absolutely no idea, because I paid attention to the NBA, but it was so difficult academically and basketball wise to balance those two things that I didn't have a lot of time, to watch NBA basketball. So it was really, really shocking when I really got into the league and really see what was expected of me.
And speaking of shocking, obviously once you got into the league, and we've talked about this before, what was it that did shock you first and foremost?
The absolute different disparity in strength and knowledge of the game. I think when the one thing is that when you look from the outside, you look at an NBA player and you think, it's just another NBA player. And the respect that I had for NBA guys, but when you get to the NBA, you realize that they're PhDs in basketball, that they may do stupid things, they may do this, they may be great guys, but they're absolutely brilliant in the game. That they're not there by accident. They're actually very gifted. They understood the game. They understand the game. They know things that coaches didn't know. I had Terry Cummins, Felton Spencer, Muggsy Bogues, Dwayne Farrell. I had Joe Smith, Latrell Sprewell. I had all these people, and they've been in the game for a very long time. And I think it's the gap the knowledge gap was very, very surprising, and the strength gap, how strong and physically gifted that they were.
Who was it that first schooled you? When I mean schooled you, took you to school when you played against them in the NBA?
So I was, we were in practice, and I am running up and down. I am their young rookie, young legs, and I'm running up and down and you know, running and spinning and getting rebounds. And I remember Terry Cummins just stepped into me and just nailed me. I mean, he nailed me. And I am looking back, and I'm like, I looked at him, and I'm like, but you're a minister. How could you hit me like that? And I remember he says, this is the NBA, young fella, not on the court, not on the court. I said, I'm like, that sells me well. You know, I'm running around like an Energizer bunny.
Donald Foyle has joined us on Sports Byline. We're talking about the professional NBA part of his very interesting life. We talked about your first instances of being in the NBA, but as you moved along and started to mature in this game, I mean, you played a double-digit years, and that gets a lot of respect from me. Any athlete that can play any professional sport, double-digit years. Tell me about that learning curve and the maturation process of Donald Foyle.
I think, you know, the fun part is that when people ask me, you know, like, how long you want to stay in the league? And I said, you know, for me, the game was always fresh because I felt like literally every day I was learning. And I think it's partly having to do with the fact that I started so late. So I felt like literally every day in the NBA was a learning. I was learning something new. At 35, I was learning. You know, I'm surprised. I'm pleasantly surprised. And I think the other thing is that it was so difficult, an adjustment, because of the instability of the Warriors organization. I mean, you come in, your first year in the thing, a coach gets choked. And then from there, you have about 8 or 9 coaches in 10 years. So it's like I never got the opportunity, I felt, to really learn what a coach's philosophy was. It was so quick. But what I got is, what is effective coaching, you know, their style, what I think works. I started paying a lot of attention to the guys in the locker room, because it's like I sensed there was like almost a disconnect in that. They were so smart in terms of the game, but they weren't respected in terms of the game and how they see the game. And I felt like, you know, when people would say, oh, this guy is a player's coach, I never understood what that meant. And what it meant was, these guys have been playing the game long enough, they can pretty much coach themselves. And you start seeing this boredom, you know, because every coach wants to come and put in a philosophy, and they weren't really talking to the players that were there. And it was so interesting, because I keep looking at them and they were absolutely bored, because they're like, you know, I know how to play the game. And if you would just ask me, it'd be... So I think for me, it was interesting, not looking at the coaches so much, but looking at the players and seeing, like, you know, how they understood the game. And when they explained the game to me, how simply they make it, you know, you just need to do this. And it wasn't like this philosophical thing. And I think it was when I met Clifford. Clifford says, he's like, you know, everybody tries to justify their job so they make the game infinitely more complicated than it really is.
Football in basket.
Exactly. He's like, it's not that difficult. You put the ball in the basket and you run back in the other way. And, you know, it's absolutely right. And players understood that.
Given your background and where you came from, the poor background you'd have, I'd be very interested in your observations of the lifestyle of professional basketball players. The money, the jewelry, the cars, the way they led their lives, the women that were always around. What was your view of that?
Well, I think for me, it was a fascinating sociological experiment. Because I think what you understand from one perspective is that you're coming from absolutely nothing. And it's like you having to figure out, you know, what to do with all of this money and whether or not you can do all the things that is demanded of you. So the thing for me that was to look at it is to look at the family dynamics, and kind of like the family themselves believe that they make the NBA if their son or kid or cousin make it. So it's that they come in and they have an expectation of wanting to be taken care of. And there's such tremendous guilt. And the part of the athlete is that because he makes it out of the ghetto, or he makes it out of this difficult situation, that he feels somewhat responsible to them. And then on the other hand, he feels that he doesn't trust anybody because he doesn't know anybody else. So he brings people around that are not necessarily in his best interest, but because he's afraid for other people to think that he's not smart or that he's not up to par, so he brings people around that he thinks he can trust, but they're not necessarily very competent. And so it's this unbelievable, like, depressing kind of analysis of and understanding the need of the athlete. But it's like they're so ill-prepared, and it's obviously not everyone, but it's so ill-prepared, including myself, about your business when you enter the NBA, because you're now making more money than most top companies in the United States. And how do you go from not even managing your checking account and not even knowing how to manage finances to managing $1 million, $2 million, $100 million? I mean, there is no knowledge. I just finished my thesis was on retirement experiences of NBA player, in which I went back and talked to 9 ex-NBA players and asked them about, you know, finances and all this kind of stuff, and talking to them about what was their retirement journey like. And one of them said to me, he's like, my mother never had a savings account, much as a checking account. I never know anything about finances. They didn't teach me anything about how to balance a checkbook in school. And he says, all of a sudden, they hand me over $1 million. He's like, I had no idea what to do with it. So I did the one thing that I could. I thought my agent, so I give it to my agent. And that's the person that I thought could take care of it. He's like, I had no knowledge of how to deal with any of this stuff. And that was, to me, very fascinating, because, and a lot of them, you know, talk like that. It's about, there is no structure in place that will tell you this is how you manage a business. And they didn't teach you that in school. You went and played basketball, and now you're a business entity, and you have no knowledge about how to do that. And I thought that was very insightful, because that's the way you feel. Even when you go to a good school like Colgate, I mean, it's a completely different thing to run like that much money, having a financial consultant, having a tax attorney, having an agent, having an assistant, having a team and a bunch of people who are working, you're needing to get a massage. I mean, you have all of these people who are trying to keep your career extended, and you now have to manage them.
Is the hardest word for a pro athlete to utter is the word no?
Yes. And the reason for that is that there's such tremendous guilt. I read about Man's Search for Meaning, about the people in Germany and making it out of the concentration camp. And many of them felt that they were so guilty about not doing more, about not saving the other person next to them. And they have this tremendous guilt among them. I think it's the same thing. When an African-American comes out of such a poverty-stricken background, they feel very much pulled that they have to do something to bring people out themselves. And they don't quite know how to do it. And usually the way they do it is to just say yes to everything, because they haven't thought about what it is I can give and what it is reasonable to give. Because for them, it's like, well, how dare I make it? And now I am this person, and now I left all these people back there. And I think they spend their life trying to figure out, how do I make a difference, and how do I help the people that I left behind, and how do I deal with the guilt about leaving those people behind and going off into the server? Because I think there's tremendous guilt.
Now that you have walked away, stepped away from the game, and you can reflect now on your contribution to the game, not a big-time scorer, not a big-time star in the NBA, but the one thing that was, a couple of things that were always said about Donald Foyle is, one of the truly good guys in sports. And I heard this recently in your last year with Orlando. They brought him in again in order to have a good influence in the locker room. Did you do that by design? I mean, as you matured, got to the end of your career, was able to think about what you'd done and what you want to be remembered for as far as playing basketball or being in a family situation on a team. Did you do that by design?
I don't think I did. I think that, you know, in my experience, I think because of it's been such a turbulent kind of existence in the NBA, in that there was the Warriors did not win a lot of games. We had so many issues on the team. And I always kind of, as I said, I spent a lot of time watching players, and I watched some of the veteran players and how they manage a locker room. And I remember when I left and went to like Orlando, for example, it was a very young team, and I don't remember exactly when I become the veteran. but I was always kind of one of the young guys, and then one day I realized that, you know, by God, I am the veteran athlete in this room.
A Donald Foyle, a man who pursued his dream. I hope you've enjoyed U.S. Airways in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, and you'll listen to our live broadcast on radio, the American Forces Network worldwide, Sirius XM satellite radio, and the Internet. And if you'd like a listing of Sports Byline USA's radio affiliates, be sure to check our award-winning website. You'll find that at sportsbyline.com. I'm Ron Barr, and thanks for being a part of America's sports talk show, Sports Byline USA.